This is ESPN 103.7 Lafayette and 104.1 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana's sports station. They say good things come in threes.
Cause it's one, two, three.
Time to test that theory. Here is RP3, D'Lo, and Mesh.
What a weekend it was. Final Four for the men and the women. An unusual ending at a PGA Tour event and an injury involved with that. NBA, got to see the Pellies live and in person. And, of course, they lost. Great atmosphere, though. And, of course, Major League Baseball. Injuries are mounting up for anyone who decides to pitch, apparently. That's their new thing the last 2 years. If you're a pitcher, you're getting injured. That's what's happening, it seems like. We'll get to it all. Good day to you. This is RP3 D'Lo and Mesh. I'm the big, bald, bearded, and beautiful one, Raymond Parks III, better known as RP3. I'm joined inside the EFCO Development Studios by a man that is known sometimes as the producer extraordinaire, other times known as the man who needs to restrain Kevin Foote and give him his medication. He's also known as the son of Iceman in 2 degrees. Dawson Iserlo is here. D'Lo, good day.
I am here. Thank you. Mike's on now. You mentioned the Pels losing, but they bounce back. We'll get to that.
Oh, yeah, we will.
Have to say that. And, exciting stuff. It was a big weekend. The PGA Tour stuff, we're going to get into that a little later because it's a... it's probably by the way, for those who listen to the show, this will be probably the most golf talk in 1 week we ever do.
It's Masters Week.
We'll have some stuff down the line for the PGA and some of the other majors as well. But this week, we'll have a couple guests dedicated to it. And it's... Yesterday, again, the Valero Texas Open is not a massive tournament. It's the last chance to qualify for the Masters, because if you win a PGA Tour event, you get in. And it was just bonkers, ridiculous stuff yesterday. I mean, I couldn't even believe it. So anyway, that and a whole lot more. Yeah, it was a wild weekend. And we got a big time week ahead. This will be the last day this week we'll be in the EFCO Development Studios, because we got a lot of crazy stuff planned for the rest of the week and into next week as well, in fact.
We do. And we're also joined inside these EFCO Development Studios for the last time in what it seems like is going to be 2 months by a man who has the best head of hair in sports talk radio. It was confirmed by Hattie Elise Parch on Friday live on the air, by the way. Sorry, Matt Miguez. It's our guy, the producer extraordinaire, James Mesh. James, good day, sir.
Well, that was Thursday, because Friday we were walk-ons.
That's correct. It was Thursday. It was still a compliment. Take it.
I'm going to
start taking it back. That's just what you're treading. You're treading.
Much like the middle reliever who has to get thrown into different situations. If he's going to keep the title, I'm going to need the versatility to be shown off. I need more than just his regular slick back thing he does every day. I need maybe a
challenge.
He mixes in the headband from time to time. I'm going to need some.
He does.
Of that.
We haven't seen it in a minute, though.
I need him to grow it out. Maybe give us the flow kind of look. I need a lot more. I need versatility. I need to know if I can toss you in the sixth inning with a couple runners on in scoring position, or if I could just rely on you in the back end with a clean slate and new fresh inning. Or maybe I need an opener one day. Maybe my starting pitching's just taxed and I need you to give me 3 innings. I need to know you can do everything before I'm giving you the title.
Can you step up to the plate, James Mesh?
Yeah, I'll see what I can do.
All right. There we go.
Yeah.
There it is. Let's get it. Hey, why don't we go ahead and unveil our poll question of the day? It is not tied to our today's special, so we can go ahead and unveil that bad boy and let the folks know what it is, what their options are. And do we have any early comments, James Mesh?
Who do you have winning tonight's men's NCAA basketball championship? Of course, there's only two options, UConn or Purdue. 3/4 of the votes are saying the Huskies. The last 1/4 are saying the Boilermakers. And yes, we did get one comment.
Love comments.
And it's from Ton. He said, Huskies look unbeatable right now, so I'll pick Purdue.
There you go.
There it is.
A little yin and yang.
There it is. Did I hear Kevin Foote earlier say that Purdue's the underdog? I mean, I know they probably are their betting favorite, but how can you be the underdog when you're a one seed and you have the 2-time national player of the year in your starting lineup?
And it's crazy because they are 7.5-point dogs at this point, too, which I would have thought it'd be closer to 4 or 5. People just buying into that UConn hype, and I understand it, but, man, it's crazy. It's crazy how dominant UConn's been here for now. You know, again, last year's tournament, they were not. They were somewhat under the radar, 4 seed. And to do it with the target on your back all year long, it's that much more impressive. And, no, we'll see. But I said this at the beginning of the tournament. I said, if there's a real class, and I thought UConn would lose, full disclosure. I thought that the, you know, the whole carryover of having won the title, not being as hungry, I thought that would catch up to him. It didn't. But I did say if there was going to be a Clash of the Titans type matchup, you know, Godzilla versus King Kong style, to shout out a very mediocre movie that had great special effects, it's UConn and Purdue, and here we go. We get it. And if you want anybody, the old pick on somebody your own size line with Zach Edey that I know people have used throughout the year, right? They, some of them get a little tired of it. He'll get Donovan Klingon tonight, who's a guy who can just about match him. Not quite in stature, but close. 7'4 versus 7'2. I can't wait to watch that matchup. From a pure basketball sense, I think it's the best matchup we could have got.
UConn did open as 7.5-point favorites, but now they moved the line a little bit to 6.5 in favor of the Huskies. So the bettors might be feeling a little bit of Purdue.
Yeah, and you never know, too. Sometimes that has to do with you know, the line moving one way or the other based on, you know, where the total money is. I don't know. I don't understand all that stuff, but I do know that it's not always as simple as the team that's getting bet on moving the line because of it. But either way, no, it should be a good game. And I think it'll be closer than what the experts are saying, at least based on where the lines have been, because I just think there's just no answer when Edey's got it going. He's got so much touch around the rim, too. I think that's something that he doesn't get a lot of credit for, because people just go, oh, he's bigger and better. What's the big deal? He's got some skillful moves down there. But again, Klingon, and by the way, it's another going to be really a key to this game is if the officials call stuff that's tight. If they whistle some fouls early, I don't think they have. The kind of common theme of the whole Final Four on both sides has been officials letting them play. I tweeted about that over the weekend. They've really, really let physicality go, and I think that's for the better. We'll see if they're able to, because, again, Edey, it's tough. Like, sometimes teams just have to hack him, but UConn might not have to if Klingon stands his ground. So I'm excited for the matchup for sure.
So keep those votes coming on our poll question of the day. Leave your comments on Facebook and X. And we'll update it throughout the remainder of today's show. But it's time for us to do what we always do at this time. It's time for today's specials.
The fellas can't help you with your lunch plans. But they can serve up the top stories of the day in bite-sized pieces.
Order up.
Time to order up today's specials on RP3, D'Lo, and Mesh.
Got to start it with the Louisiana Raging Cajuns baseball team. They've won 15 games in a row. That's the longest winning streak in the nation, and we've been talking about that for a while here. Once it was up to 10, 11, 12 games. Now they get three more with a sweep over ULM, and that has alerted the national folks to the situation. Rankings coming out, 19th in the D1 baseball poll, 24th in the Baseball America poll. They are basically represented in every top 25 entity that I have seen come out with their rankings today. The Raging Cajuns are officially on the national agenda now. So this is big for them, and it puts them in the conversation of not only being a potential regional team, which is obviously looking a lot better than it was before, but putting them back in the hosting conversation, which after that rough weekend in Houston, especially after that series loss to Rice, I think we kind of put those thoughts to bed for a long time. Now you start having to bring them up again. Now here's the deal. With all that being said, they've won 15 in a row. They're playing as well as any team in the country is right now. No doubt about it. The meat of their conference slate is still to come, and I think we're going to learn a whole lot about this team, not only this weekend a little bit with Marshall, but again, Marshall, not a team that's expected to finish towards the top of the league, but in a few weeks, you have a stretch where you play Coastal and Southern Miss back-to-back. Those are the other two Sun Belt teams that are in the conversation to host regionals and that are going to continue to be a factor. Coastal still in those rankings as well. Some rankings have Coastal a couple spots ahead of the Cajuns. I believe D1 Baseball has the Cajuns one spot ahead of the Chanticleers. All in all, they have a lot of business left to handle, and I'm excited to see how they react to kind of this whole situation. We just talked about UConn or the Cajuns. It's kind of similar, right? Now that everybody is talking about you, and now that you're getting some of the respect you probably feel you've deserved for longer than that, how do you answer that? So far, they've backed it up. They swept the Warhawks of ULM over the weekend, so we'll see if they keep it going. On the other end of things, LSU continues to struggle. They lost 2 of 3. I got to see just about all of the Friday game, which was, of course, the middle game of that series against Vanderbilt after they had won the opener. You're feeling good about their chances to win the series. Felt like they kind of let one slip away on Friday. Vandy just found a way to get some runs off the relief pitching. And all in all, it was kind of a microcosm of the issues that LSU's had. A couple of defensive mistakes, some pitching issues, and the offense good, but just not good enough to put you over the top. They lose that game, and that had to make you worried, and then it kind of came unraveled on Saturday. They get run ruled again. That's the third time this year. 13-3, Vandy takes care of them and wins a series 2 out of 3. So the Tigers fall to 3-9, and they fall out of the rankings in most publications. Obviously, again, they've still got plenty of time, and the beauty of playing in the SEC, it's the beauty and the curse, right? The curse is that you don't get a break here. You're going to play another top 10 team in Tennessee on the road this weekend. The beauty of it is you keep having opportunities. You can prove yourself, and if you win a series on the road in Knoxville, I think people will start to put them right back in their top 25 rankings and right back in the conversation of everything they want to accomplish. So it's looking rough right now, but in the SEC, it's only as rough as your next opponent, and they've got a chance to try and turn the tides against Tennessee. Lastly, quickly, McNeese. They had to play one of the hottest teams in the country. We talked about it in Lamar. They went out early and caught them off guard a little bit. Beat them on Friday night, played very well in that game. Then they had a chance to beat them both of the next 2 days. They got no hit on Saturday in extra innings, 1-0. A really good, well-pitched game on both sides. But unfortunately, the Cowboys couldn't find any offense. And then the rubber match on Sunday with the series on the line, they just couldn't quite find enough offense as well. 4-3, they lose it. So they lose 2 out of 3. But I think all things considered, probably more positives than negatives. Lamar is right now the favorite in the Southland Conference and is playing as well. Had just come off of a sweep of Oklahoma. And you went on the road and gave them everything they could handle in a 3-game set. So we'll see if McNeese, now that the schedule will get a little softer from here on out in conference play, we'll see if they can start to get on a roll and maybe find themselves towards the top of those standings. All in all, big time weekend in Louisiana college baseball, and that's only going to continue here in the next couple of weeks.
My special for today is the New Orleans Pelicans. They are wildly entertaining for all the right reasons and the wrong reasons. They're a bit schizophrenic. I'm in the Smoothie King Center Friday night, and yes, Zion's not going to play because of the laceration on the finger. No B.I., no Zion. C.J. McCollum comes out. He's hot early. They're feeding the big fella, Valanciunas, down low. He's getting his. And they're playing a team 40 games below 500 in the San Antonio Spurs. I can confirm, as I shared on social media on Friday night, that Wimby is, in fact, a tall human. Just to let you know, saw him in the postgame presser. He is, in fact, a very, very tall individual. They blew a double-digit lead again against an awful Spurs team. And Wimby didn't even have a good game. Like, he struggled to get to double-double status late. They did a nice job of frustrating him. He couldn't get into a rhythm offensively. C.J. McCollum was hot early. I talked about Valanciunas, but then Valanciunas got into some foul trouble. Some of them were ticky-tack. Wimby got some calls where I was like, eh. The Usher, who was there where I was sitting for media, same row with Les East, by the way, our good friend. The Usher was very vocal about the calls. She did not feel like they went the Pelicans' way, in case you were wondering. But they have a double-digit lead against a team 40 games below 500, and they yak it away. Inexcusable. And their execution down the stretch, once again, was awful. Herb Jones is a very good player. I'm not for sure what he was thinking on the next last possession, where he comes around the defender, and the only thing between him and the goal is the 7'4" guy who likes blocking shots. And you, do you know what the 7'4" guy did to Herb Jones's shot?
He blocked it.
He blocked it. And Willie doesn't take a timeout before then. He just lets it go. He has timeouts in his back pocket. Then they come down again for, they still have a chance. They come down for another possession, and Herb just lets the ball right out of his hands. And they were terrible defensively on the three-point shot. Devontae Graham, former Pelly, discarded. Willie Green says, get out of my face. I don't want you on my team no more. Guess what? He lights them up. Drains 4 three-pointers. It was a head-scratcher. They gave up 17 threes to the Spurs. To the Spurs. And just choked away a double-digit lead at home for their 4th straight loss and their 5th in 6 games, by the way. And everyone in the Smoothie King Center was deflated. Everyone. C.J. McCollum did not want to talk to us afterwards. The Usher lady that I mentioned earlier, she was calling out the team late. She was raising her voice very loudly. She was very friendly to me, just so I'm clear here. But she was giving the Pellies the business. And then we're like, okay, they have to go on the road and begin a 4-game road trip against Phoenix, who has owned them. And what did they do? They beat the Suns. Of course they do. It's exactly what this Pelicans team is. They go, they take out the Pellies, and Zion took over. He was magnificent. I could argue that was the best game of his pro career. What he did last night on the road against the Suns was absolutely phenomenal. It was also, credit to my guy Lopes, Andrew Lopez of ESPN, last night was Zion's first time making multiple two-point jumpers outside of 10 feet in the same game ever. 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 Okay? Now, Zion was in his bag. Best game I've seen him play probably as a Pelican. And they needed it, right? It was gut check time. They had lost 5 of 6, just got embarrassed at home by the Spurs. You need it. And I'm not trying to rain on the Pelly's parade, so please don't take it that way. But last night's win, I look at the standings this morning. Do you know who's still in the play-in tournament? Do you know who's still behind the Phoenix Suns? It's the New Orleans Pelicans. Like, that's what they are, because they lost the tiebreaker. So it was a great win. Don't get me wrong. Great win for the Pelly's. It looks like they're going to be locked into the play-in tournament, though, because they have these games left. At Portland, that should be a win, but we thought San Antonio was going to be a win. We thought Orlando was going to be a win, and those two games proved otherwise. At Sacramento, who's in the play-in tournament, fighting for positioning. Golden State, who's fighting for positioning in the play-in tournament. And then you wrap up the season at home against LeBron James, Anthony Davis, inside the Smoothie King Center. I think the Pels are going to be in the playoffs via the play-in tournament. But you never do know.
They are locked into the play-in tournament, at least, yes.
Well, there's that. Yay. Yay. We were talking about this team being a top 4 seed in the West. And they've lost 5 of, like, their last it's just... It's a great win last night. Can they keep this rolling? Can they possibly sneak up and overtake someone in the standings? We'll find out by Sunday. That's when we'll find out.
I'll quickly go for my Today Special, and it was the Women's National Championship yesterday. It was a highly touted matchup, of course. You remember that Iowa knocked out South Carolina last year to get to the final to face LSU. So this is 2 years in a row that they make it to the National Championship, while South Carolina won it a couple years ago. Big matchup storylines throughout the whole game, of course. It was the best player in the game for Caitlin Clark and for Iowa, while it's the best team for South Carolina as they were coming into this game 37-0. And it kind of went about as you expected, not necessarily early on, because Iowa shot the lights out. It was a barrage of threes really quickly from Iowa and Caitlin Clark as they took a quick 20-9 lead early on in the quarter. But as you got later on in the game, South Carolina really settled in. They put Raven Johnson on Caitlin Clark, who ended the first quarter with 18 points, 18 of her 30. But as you went throughout the rest of the game, Raven really affected Caitlin. She was not able to shoot proficiently. She took some questionable shots at points. It felt very questionable, or more of desperation, I should say, because as South Carolina got more and more into the game, you could tell that they imposed their will. They dominated the boards. Camilla Cardoso, the bunch of South Carolina players, they handled business throughout the game. And it showed, because as you watch, they dominated the boards. They won 51-29. They got a total of 8 blocks. 3 of them came from Camilla. 2 of them came from Raven Johnson. A couple of players off the bench had got them as well. They end up winning 87-75. To complete the perfect season. It was huge. Caitlin Clark, she got her. She still got 30 points. But the rest of the team, the starting lineup looked good. Kate Martin, she had 16. Hannah Stolke, she had 11. But it was the paint presence from those South Carolina defenders that really put pressure on Iowa. I was shocked. I thought by the end of the game, we were going to both see both teams either get to 100 or near 100 because of how high of scoring we saw in the first half, but it got a little bit more normal in the second half. And by the end of it all, South Carolina ends up hoisting the trophy, becoming national champions once again. We'll talk about it more as we take a time out here, but more RP3 D'Lo Mesh coming up after this.
Back to the sports talk you not only want, but need. This is ESPN, 1037 Lafayette and 1041 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana's sports station.
Welcome back in RP3, D'Lo and Mesh. It's, you know, we haven't really addressed something that's been everybody's talking about. It's the eclipse today. We're probably not going to see any of it because there's about 917 clouds in the air. But, you know, I saw our friends over in Jonesboro, Kara Ritchie, friend of the program, they, like, the hotel prices went bonkers because everybody was going. Apparently, like, that's part of the, you know, direct path where you get the full experience.
Yes, sir, that's the direct path.
And so you're talking, like, $300-$400 for, like, these motels on the side of the road in Jonesboro this weekend, or this week, today and stuff. That's crazy.
Talk about price gouging? No, that never happens.
No, there'd be more integrity involved with those places, right? No, I mean, listen, that might fund those businesses for the next 5 years, to be honest with you. But
that's amazing.
Yeah. No, it is. I
the eclipse, the other thing that we haven't talked about, and it wasn't part of our today's specials, how about the news that's going to seismically shift college basketball?
No, it is. John Calipari is likely headed to Arkansas. They're finalizing some things, supposedly, but
The man turned down coaching and being part of the front office of the Lakers and the Cavs in recent years for monster money. Turned down the UCLA job in recent years, and things have deteriorated to the point in Lexington between him and the administration and the fan base that he is going to leave Kentucky after 15 years to go to Arkansas. Now, I am old enough to remember when Arkansas basketball was really good, when they just ran you to death. Okay, back in the day, and they won a national championship that way. You can win at Arkansas. Look, we saw Musselman. Didn't they go to the Elite Eight during his time, right? And he had them as a perennial tournament team. Apparently, John Calipari is also very good good friends, besties, if you will, with the heir to the Tyson Chicken fortune. So, and he is an Arkansas donor. Apparently, Jerry Jones has been part of this as well. So, they're going to throw a ton of money at John Calipari, reportedly. Also, there's going to be a ton of NIL money involved. So, I get it. And if you're Kentucky, you're okay with this because things have gotten stale in Lexington with Cal there, right? They've fallen short of their expectations. A lot of early exits in the NCAA tournament. Haven't been to a Final Four since 2015, I do believe. So it's been a minute, and you don't have to worry about the buyout because Cal's leaving voluntarily. So then you're going to have this musical chairs with coaching. I know I've already been asked about it, about Will Wade. I don't think Kentucky is a destination. Our buddy Jim Gazzolo has been reporting on this, that he's not even taking phone calls, that he is content. He's happy in Lake Charles for the McNeese Cowboys. Now, what Kentucky does could open up a possible dream job that maybe Will Wade could be unable to say no to, right? Where does Kentucky go? Did they go after Nate Oates, who just took Alabama to the Final Four for the first time in program history? Really good coach. You know he can recruit. Do you go after someone like Scott Drew, who brought stability to the Baylor men's basketball program after the tragedy and scandal? And, oh, by the way, he knows how to recruit. He has his team in the tournament all the time, and he is a national championship winner. So, Billy Donovan's name has been thrown out there. Would he leave coaching the Oklahoma City Thunder to come back to college to coach at Kentucky? I don't think so, but you never do know. The Wildcats will be backing up the Brinks truck for whoever they want to get, and I think it's going to be a short list. Some reports already have it out, Dawson, that Hurley, the man who is favored in tonight's national championship game to win back-to-back national titles at UConn, that Kentucky's going to make him a godfather offer that he can't refuse. We'll see what happens, but I would expect Kentucky to have a head coach within the next 3 to 4 days, and it may not take that long. I do have one more final thought. I like Cal. I think he's a really good coach. I thought he was the best coach at the time for Kentucky and in that era of one and done. He did a really good job. I don't think he's figured out this NIL stuff and this new era that it is where everyone has one and dones. It doesn't seem like Cal has the advantage that others did. But him leaving Kentucky and going to Arkansas feels a lot like Jimbo Fisher leaving Florida State and going to Texas A&M. And you're going to pay him a lot of money for a guy that's won a chip, knows how to recruit, has that tag about him, knows how to coach star players. It didn't work out in A&M. It feels a little Jimbo-esque to me, but I'm just going to leave that out there for that.
It's an interesting point. I didn't think of it that way. The one thing with Dan Hurley, I would say, is I actually spent some time the last week or so kind of listening to a lot of the backstory, and I think I referenced this PJ Carlissimo, who I have a lot of respect for. He kind of gave a lot of the story because he's connected to that family. Northeast guys are different when it comes to basketball. You know, like Northeast basketball is its own thing. He's a Northeast guy. He's from Jersey City. He played at, I think, Seton Hall, and he's coached at UConn now. I would be surprised if he was interested in going to the Southeast. But, hey, maybe that's his next, big challenge. And if you throw double-digit $1 million at somebody, maybe that changes the way they think. Let's head out to the Mike's Marine Hotline. Welcome David onto the show, who's got some thoughts on this same topic as well. David, what's going on?
Yes. Oh, not much. Thanks for taking my call. Real quick, you mentioned Will Wade. Does Will Wade realistically have a chance of getting that position? Would they even look at him? Doesn't he still have the NCAA situation hanging over his head?
At Kentucky, no. At one of those jobs, let's say they hire Nate Oates away from Alabama, I could see him taking that job. I don't think Kentucky would be, but I it's not going to surprise me in the next year or so, David, to see Will Wade coaching in the SEC again.
Really? Have they settled that NCAA situation yet?
Well, there's the show clause. Yeah, it's been settled. That's why he had to serve the 10-game suspension to start the season at McNeese. There is the show clause and everything like that, but that's been taken care of, yes. So, yeah.
Okay. Now, you mentioned Cal, and you're right. Cal hasn't adjusted to the portal and NIL. And he was on the top of the heap before all of this thing came about, and now he just hasn't adjusted it. And I don't see how that'll work out in Arkansas.
Well, we'll see. Your point, it's a good point as well, right? Now, does he get reinvigorated? Is it one of those things where he needs a new location, right, and he's going to recommit himself to being the best coach? And at Arkansas, could he have an immense amount of success there like he did in other places in his career when he didn't have 7 McDonald's prep All-Americans on the roster, right? So I think Cal's a good enough coach. He proved that at Memphis and even before then back in the days at UMass when he had Chaney want to choke him out in a press conference, which is legendary and amazing. But I think he can coach. If he goes to Arkansas, does that make him a national title contender? I would say no.
Yeah, and it's nothing against his coaching. It's just a matter of adjusting.
Exactly.
That's what I'm looking at. Have a good one.
Thank you, David. Appreciate the phone call. Yeah, I think he takes them up another level. Could I see Cal in a couple years in Fayetteville leading them to a Final Four? Absolutely. And I know you're thinking, well, Ray, if you get to a Final Four, then you're only, 2 wins away from a national title. That's true, but we see a lot of teams make those runs and get to the Final Four, and then they're not on the same level as the national championship. So
yeah.
I'm just saying.
The last thing I would say, too, is I think it's interesting. Like I don't know if the drop-off at Kentucky has been related to NIL stuff. They still have one of the most talented rosters every year, and we see that by all the documented NBA players that he has more than anybody. So he's had the talent. I think he's kind of had some shortcomings in getting those guys ready to win college basketball games.
And that's fair.
And so I do wonder, I would imagine he's going to take a different approach at Arkansas. And to an extent, you have to, right? Even though it's Cal's bringing his brand, Arkansas is not Kentucky. And so I do think there's a chance they're more successful. Look, honestly, there's a really good chance they're more successful than what he's been the last 4 years at Kentucky, which isn't getting out of the first weekend. But yeah, you obviously have to make some changes there. And I would imagine this is a chance for him to kind of refresh his approach. And, you know, maybe he puts a few less players in the NBA out of Arkansas, but maybe he wins a few more games. I think
maybe
both
he has more
true.
Guys stick around, and it'd be interesting to see how many Kentucky players.
Right. Well, at least the recruits, too.
Yes.
He's already supposedly already been in contact. Some guys have already talked about it.
So we'll see. We'll keep an eye on that. So we got to take a timeout. More RP3 D'Lo and Mesh coming up right here on ESPN Southwest Louisiana Sports Station.
Go sign up for our rewards club at ESPNSouthwestLouisiana.com so you can score tickets, gift certificates, and much more. This is ESPN 1037 Lafayette and 1041 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana's sports station.
You know, you can sign up for our rewards club, but you don't have to sign up to call in on the Mike's Marine Hotline. You just got to dial us at 337-706-0111, and that's what Mike has done. So we welcome Mike onto the show now. Mike, what's going on?
Good morning. I want to correct Ray on something.
Okay.
That's okay. Billy Donovan does not coach the Oklahoma City Thunder. He hasn't in a couple of years. He's with the Chicago Bulls. He left to go to a bigger market. He may regret that now because of the way the Thunder have progressed. And Bulls have sort of stagnated. A lot of that was the injury to Lonzo Ball. He got the Thunder right where they're competitive, and now they're winning and have a chance to get this far in the playoffs.
So do
so
you
I don't
think
know if Ray know that? You said,
well, no, I'm not.
Where he's at now.
No, I'm not. I appreciate that, but I forgot where Billy Donovan was. I appreciate the correction. Do you think he'd leave an NBA job to come back to college?
I don't know. Right now, I say no because in the NBA, you don't have to worry about recruiting a new team every year. You have guys on the contract.
That's a fair point. That's an interesting point too. And Billy's been after Oklahoma City took the Chicago, so he's been coaching in the NBA for how long?
A while now, yeah.
Like,
he's been with Chicago since 2020.
So 7 or 8
to Florida, where it was 7-0-8.
Yeah, ooh, man, it's been that long. It's been that long since the back-to-back for the Gators. I don't know. Billy, they'll make a phone call to Billy, though, I'm sure. I just don't know. I mean, the Bulls are a disaster, so maybe he would come back. It is Kentucky. I mean, it's still Kentucky, so I don't know.
Well, one other point on Will Wade. Will Wade show cause in at the end of next season.
Correct.
It was a 3-year show cause. He spent 1 year out of coaching. He spent this past season at McNeese with a suspension. So his desire to stay at McNeese one more year may be related to where he doesn't want to have the limitations he had with being able to recruit off campus and things like that. That he has at McNeese that he still has now.
But that didn't affect Bruce Pearl. That's a good point. But that didn't affect Bruce Pearl when he took the Auburn job because he was still under show cause. So the suspension is taken care of. The show cause portion is part of it. And to your point, I've long said this. I don't think Will Wade is going to leave. I think he wants to stay 2 years at McNeese and then he'll leave. That's what he's told everyone. I think that's what he wants to do is that he wants to stay in Lake Charles. He's grateful for the opportunity they gave him. But I don't think he's going to leave unless someone backs up the Brinks truck for him. That's the only way that I think that happens.
Yeah, and I don't think that's going to happen this season. Other schools, you know, despite what Bruce Pearl did, they weren't calling the phone with the FBI actually after him. That's a little different. And so I think other schools who may be reluctant to look at him now won't have that reluctance a year from now when basically his punishment will have been paid. So I haven't heard he said he's going to stay at Lake Charles only 2 years. I think that's maybe he said that privately. I haven't said that publicly. But I expect he'll be moving on out the next season. All right. That's all I wanted to mention. Nice talking to you guys.
Appreciate it.
Appreciate it, Mike. No, he hasn't said that publicly only 2 years. But he has said publicly in the last few weeks that he's coming back for another season and that he's not going anywhere. And he's said it repeatedly. Our buddy Jim Gazzolo has done a lot of reporting on that. Now, you know, if Kentucky comes, I don't know. I don't think Kentucky's going to go after Wade. I could be wrong, right? We're wrong on these things all the time. But for me, I do think he comes back to McNeese another year. He'll be there for 2 years. I think he wants to win an NCAA tournament game. And then can go and pick the jobs. And look, in college athletics, there's constantly great jobs open every single year. Every single year there is.
Yeah, and there's going to be. Now, you know, Look, Billy Napier waited for a couple of years because of the right fit, and he had a perfect storm to come back and everything like that. So you can have instances where, you know, maybe it's – so I'm not saying it's locked in at 2 years, but you definitely get the idea that Will Wade's ready to be back on the big-time scene at some point. But now, I don't know if now is that time. You're right about that. And so, you know, look, the musical chairs that happens now, like again, the Kentucky job may, you know, be taken by someone who from Alabama, and then the Alabama job might be taken by someone from another university, and then, you know, like that stuff can happen in a hurry, because at this point in the year too, there's not all that many different, you know, possibilities, and we'll see who takes some of the openings that are left. But that can trigger off a chain of events. I just think it would have to be the perfect situation for him to leave because of also all he's already got invested. Look, he's already got Joe Charles. He's already got guys coming in for next year too. So I think it would take a lot for him to be willing to part with what he already built here at McNeese.
Mesh, your thoughts?
I was taking a phone call.
Yeah,
I wasn't hearing what y'all were saying.
No, yeah, it was mainly just about the Will Wade situation, and you know, let's go back to Mr. Green on the hotline. Haven't heard from Mr. Green in a while, but he's got some thoughts on some of the day's topics. How's it been?
Good morning, fellas. It's been all right. I had a sick kid I had to go pick up from daycare, so she's asleep in the back seat, and I'm driving around listening to y'all.
The man is taking full advantage of the sick kid. I have done that myself.
Absolutely. A little break.
Yes.
A little break. I get to listen to y'all for a change because I maybe get to catch like the first 20 minutes of your show most days, and then I got to, you know, go to class and everything. So.
How dare you be responsible? How dare you?
I mean, you know, adulting and everything. I know. I need to do better, right?
That's correct, bud. That's correct. So what's on your mind, buddy?
Look, I'm really hoping, first of all, poll question of the day, I'm going to go with the Huskies just because, as Ton pointed out, they look unbeatable, and I just don't think Purdue's got it in them to beat them. And now that said, we keep saying, oh, Purdue doesn't have it in them for the bright lights, and they'll get knocked out early. Oh, well, they'll get knocked out in the next round. Oh, they'll get knocked out in the next round. So, you know, maybe they could do the impossible, but I just don't see it happening. And as far as the whole Coach Calvin in Arkansas, I hope he does well. I hope that they go back to their old school way of just running the floor and just tiring people out to the point where they just can't do it anymore. I don't think that's his style, but, you know, sometimes you got to adjust. And so hopefully he does that. And then my question for Kentucky is this. Are they going to go after one of those big names? Or since it didn't really work out with Coach Cal, are they going to go maybe for a name that's kind of under the radar that nobody really is thinking of?
Ooh, it's a good question. We'll answer that. Thank you, Jamie. I appreciate you, bud.
Appreciate it, guys. Y'all have a great day.
They're going to go after a big name. And look, in the grand scheme of things, did Cal work out? Once again, I've said this before. LSU baseball, Kentucky basketball, and Alabama football, they're all kind of built the same way with their fan bases. The expectation is national championship every single year, right? Like that. And if they don't get that, they're not happy. And that's how they're built. Kentucky winning one national championship, that's forever ago, right? Like, just think about that for a second. And I think the bigger thing at Kentucky, things started underperforming. The fact that they hadn't been to a Final Four since 2015, right, is the thing I think irks them more, right? If they had been to a Final Four or two recently, I think he's only been to four in 15 years. Now, for most programs, that is wildly successful. But the standard at Kentucky is what the standard at Kentucky is. Plain and simple. It's unrealistic. It is foolish on some level, you could argue. But that's what it is. So I don't think they're going to go for an up-and-comer here. I think they're going to go and make a splash and get a name and get someone that can come in and they feel like can make them a national title contender and actually live up to the expectations right off the bat.
You got to wonder if they're going to consult Drake on this because he's been in the
I saw someone say Drake's entered the portal. He's making his way to Fayetteville to join his coach.
I love the shot of him in the full tracksuit with the team in the meeting room. Man, that was awesome. But anyway, we have to take a timeout. Some people probably have no idea what I'm talking about, but just...
I do.
It's awesome. Anyway, we'll be right back. Wrap up hour number one of RP3 D'Lo and Mesh.
You're listening to ESPN 103.7 Lafayette and 104.1 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana's sports station and your home for the LSU Tigers.
Welcome back to RP3 D'Lo Mesh as you're listening to ESPN 103.7 Lafayette and 104.1 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana sports station. Wrapping up hour number one here in the EFCO Development Studios. Hour number two going to be pretty jam-packed. We're going to be talking Pels with Ali Cassell, while we're also going to be talking about those Houston Astros with Brian Lalima of Sports Talk 790. But I do want to update you on the poll question of the day.
Oh, let's update that poll.
We had asked you on Facebook and on X, who do you have winning tonight in the men's NCAA basketball championship? Slight change in the votes. Now 67% of you have said UConn, while the other 33% have said Purdue. So we got a couple extra votes going towards the Boilermakers, who had the line move from initially them being 7.5-point underdogs to now being 6.5-point underdogs.
I'm really interested to see, too, the coaching chess match here that takes place. We know about Matt Painter and kind of the shortcomings, right? Well, he's overcome that, and let's remember, the last time a team, and this is continuing a pretty nice trend for teams that lose to 16 seeds getting redemption, right? Virginia did it as well. So we'll see what he does against Dan Hurley, who we know is just, by the way, got enough. Here's the thing, too, and I've said this about guys like Tiger Woods and Michael Jordan, right? The greatest of all time. I'm not putting Dan Hurley in those categories, but he's got enough of the insanity in him. Like, you could just see that there's a couple screws loose, and I mean that in a good way. Like, he's yelling at about every call. I mean, there was, like, literally just, you know, random plays in the game, and he's acting like he's losing his entire mind. That usually is only the case for some of the coaches who are, you know, some of the best. So I think he's got a little bit of that in him. But what are the coaching adjustments look like? Is he able, you know, and we talked about this as well last week. Neither coach has nearly as much time for this game as they did for the last one. So when Jay Wright, who I mentioned on Footnotes, did a great breakdown of some of the stuff Hurley did to get his players involved and get the ball, you know, not only in the hands of Klingon, but in some of his playmakers, he doesn't have as much time to draw some of that up and initiate it, right? This is going to be, you know, I don't want to say it's going to be a street ball game and just, you know, ISO situations, but how can teams do the stuff that they've been doing all year, and how can the defense, you know, kind of counter that stuff? And I think we'll see a lot of that in the early stages of this game, because you only had 2 days to prepare, even though, yeah, I'm sure these teams had a preliminary scouting report on UConn or Purdue, respectively. You know, they had to be focusing on NC State and Alabama, and we know that. So I'm also interested to see how much this game looks different than the two semifinals did.
You know, it's an intriguing matchup. UConn has the experience of being here last year and winning the whole thing. And Hurley, obviously, is a passionate coach, and he has that experience as well. We know about Purdue. They finally kind of get over the hump, and they're there. They have the two-time National Player of the Year, the big fella. It is UConn and how they defend Edney is going to be key for me, right? Like, it was very much over the weekend for the women's game, the women's title game, right? Caitlin Clark went off, right? She scored 18 points in that first quarter, set an NCAA championship game record for the women for most points in a quarter. And you know what South Carolina did the rest of the way? They held her to 12 points. She ended up going, what, 10 of 25 or 10 of 26 from the field? They made the adjustment. They took the prolific scorer out of the game. Iowa's bench had 0 points in a national title game. And South Carolina had all that depth, and they just brought in wave after wave after wave, and they frustrated Caitlin, and they won the game. They made the in-game adjustments Dawn Staley did, who, by the way, just won her third national championship as a head coach since 2017. That experience on how to make those adjustments in a national title game with so much little turnaround from your Final Four game, to your point, Dawson, I think is a huge advantage for UConn. It doesn't mean Purdue can't win. It just means big advantage for the Huskies. We got to take a timeout. Keep those votes coming on our poll question of the day. Leave your comments on Facebook and X. We'll kick off hour number two with Ali Cassell, our buddy who covers the Pels. That's coming up next right here on ESPN, Southwest Louisiana Sports Station.
This is ESPN 103.7 Lafayette and 104.1 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana's sports station. They say good things come in threes.
Because it's one, two, three.
Time to test that theory. Here is RP3, D'Lo, and Mesh.
Hour number two has arrived on this rainy, stormy, eclipse of the heart type of day on RP3, D'Lo, and Mesh. You see what I did there?
I do.
Yeah, there we go.
That was good stuff.
There we go. Thank you. Thank you. Hour one was great. We had some great phone calls from our listeners that called up the Mike's Marine hotline. We covered a lot of topics. We did college baseball. UL continues to be the hottest team maybe in the country. Definitely playing as the best team in the state of Louisiana right now. Raging Cajuns, Matt Deggs' team. They keep just piling up the wins. LSU, they're on the struggle bus. Started off SEC play losing their first four series since the first time, I do believe, since 1969, which is an unbelievable thing. We also talked about the women's Final Four, the men's Final Four. We talked about those Pellies. And to talk more about those Pelicans, who were schizophrenic over the weekend, is the man who knows them better than anyone else I know. Ollie Cassell joins us now. Ollie, good day to you, brother. How are you, my friend?
Doing a lot better, Raymond, since the last time I saw you in person, right?
Yeah, it was we had a great moment on Friday inside the Smoothie King Center. I think my favorite moment was how disgruntled the ushers were about the team and how they played. And how vocal they were about it. It just hit the end of the game. They were just so angry. Okay, so let's go back to Friday. They find a way to blow a double-digit lead to one of the worst teams in the NBA, 40 games under 500, and they do so at home. And it kind of just capped a terrible homestand for them. And, you know, no Zion, no B.I., yet they should have still been able to beat San Antonio. When we were talking after the press conference on Friday night, we didn't seem to be too optimistic about this team's chances. What went wrong for them at home? Was it something as simple as not having B.I. out there?
I think it was multiple things. That was definitely one of them, right? Brandon's, which I completely and always repeatedly say and believe in, is the fact that he's this team's floor. He gives them a legitimate floor, right? He's the de facto point guard. He's their best three-level scorer. He's a guy he can rely on. His defense has come around. So he's one of the leaders of the team, maybe the biggest leader on the team, not in terms of, you know, being vocal, but the guy who just, you know, everybody follows suit. So you don't have him. As you mentioned, Zion was out without a finger. I think you can't overlook the fact he didn't have Jose Alvarado. You lost Najee. And when you lose those energy guys, which is a part of this team's identity, that it detracts, right? So it's a combination of things. Plus, I know Spurs overall are one of the worst teams, but Raymond, they came into that game playing pretty darn good basketball, right? Where in their previous five games, they had three wins and two very close losses. And yeah, it's just they somehow are peaking around their Victor Wembanyama, who was the best player. Pelicans needed somebody to kind of match that energy intensity. And, you know, CJ McCollum hasn't been able to live up to that task when the spotlight's been completely on him. So yeah, that was miserable. For some reason, at home seems to bring out the worst in this team. Because when they go on the road, and we saw it last night again, they're a much better team, right? They play better together for closer to 48 minutes.
Was that the best game you've seen Zion play on Sunday night in Phoenix?
I think it is. I mean, you can probably point to bring out some statistics or talk about how he had, right before he got hurt with his hamstring a year ago, he had a bigger stretch, right, where it was more consistent MVP-like performances because he was in that talk. But considering what this game meant last night to the Pelicans, right, if you wanted to keep any kind of legitimate hopes of finishing in the top six, and Zion's never played right down the stretch of a season, well, he came through flying colors, right, leading that team on both ends of the floor. I think we saw how Zion can make a case for being an All-NBA player. Right, he's not going to be one of those guys, like I just mentioned, B.I., three-level scorer. He's not a Kevin Durant. Teams can load up on him because his offensive game is limited. But how he can make his impact is by using athleticism all over the court, and we saw it, right? So he was setting up teammates. He had about 30 drives in yesterday's game, a ridiculous number. And then defensively, when he was getting beat off the dribble, which didn't happen much, he was recovering and coming up with block shots against like Kevin Durant. So we saw in full effect, I thought, Duke Zion. Right, where he's jumping around. I thought he started the game well, too. Right, I got to mention how rebounding. He had, I think, five rebounds at the end of that first quarter. So he played and expended as much energy as I've ever seen him. And look what happened. It led the team to a big, big win.
He actually made, for the first time ever in his career, 2 10-foot-plus jump shots.
Yeah.
Like just think about, that's such an insane stat. Does he need to play the way he did yesterday down the stretch for them to, obviously they've locked up the play-in tournament because everyone else has been eliminated. But does he need to play this way that he played last night down the stretch for them to maybe sneak in and avoid the play-in tournament? And do you even think that's a possibility?
I do. It's funny with the Pelicans, they've had like 3 bad losing streaks this season, right? They just lost before winning last night 4 straight games. But previously, they had only lost 3 or more games in a row twice. And every time they did that, they bounced back in a big way. So this team does respond well to adversity. And I think the coaching staff always has their ears because you see the adjustments, right? Saw it last night. I thought offensive game plan was spectacular in the way opposing teams like to load up on Zion. So I feel like they found something. And momentum on the road for this team feels real, too. So most of the games are going to be on the road. And it's not against the elite teams, right? It's not against the Minnesota's, OKC, Boston, right? It's on teams that are more on thinner ice, right? Portland, you should beat. But the Kings are reeling. They're down without 2 key players. So you feel like that should be a victory, especially since the Pelicans have just owned Sacramento, right? 4-0. 3 of those have been blowouts. And then I don't think the Warriors are playing all that well. I know that they've revived themselves. Don't have to worry about Houston catching them. But if the Pelicans play their style of basketball, and if Steph Curry's not getting 40 or 50, I just feel like the Pelicans should win that game too, even though it's on a back-to-back. But they'll have a good chance. And then it comes down to the Lakers, right? Team with so much history that the Pelicans have against, where it's been mostly bad history, right? But they have had signs of where they can, you know, dominate that action. I remember a couple years ago when they got in the playoffs, right? Willie Green's inaugural year. They beat the Lakers in 2 big key games down the stretch, got in the play-in, and we saw what happened from there. So I feel like the schedule's lending itself to where the Pelicans, if they win 3 or 4, they'll give themselves a chance for a top 6, right? Because Phoenix's closing stretch of the schedule, much tougher, Raymond. But if they don't, I feel like, okay, worst case scenario is what? Can you hang on to 7? Because that means then you would have possibly 2 home games here at home to get into the playoffs. And I know we just talked about how they're bad at home, but when you've got something on the line, and I think Zion, he's been saying it all year, right? He lives for these moments, and the way he just came out, yeah, if he just plays anything remotely to that caliber, to where he's bringing it on both ends, you feel like they've got a really good chance, either path, of being in the playoffs, getting into the first round.
We're speaking with Ollie Cassell. He's a Pels reporter. Ollie, you know, that's kind of where I wanted to go, a little bit of an expansion on those scenarios. You know, there's some other really big games. For instance, L.A.'s going to host the Warriors tomorrow night, and for now, the Warriors still have a ton to play for because they could jump up to 9, and, you know, each individual ladder spot within the play-in tournament is much more valuable than the one below it based on the home court, and obviously the big jump if you get to 8 and you don't have to play an extra game potentially, or obviously 7 where you get 2 chances. So what do you make of the situations that the Pels are in, and do you give them a better shot to get back to 6 than maybe we were originally kind of thinking of here?
Well, 6 is going to be entirely on what Phoenix does, right? Yeah, 4 games left for both teams. Pelicans have to finish with just 1 more win, right? But when you're talking about 4 games, does that mean they got to go 4-0 if Phoenix goes 3-1, or they somehow, hopefully, right, go 2-2, then 3-1 does the trick, which is a lot more manageable. But like I said, I've got my eyes more set on just make sure you're, if you can't get in the top 6, hang on to number 7, right? Okay, and maybe 8, but here's the thing. When you look at the standings, right, tied with Phoenix Suns, although they own the tiebreaker, but the Kings, only 1 game back. Lakers, 1.5. So if the Pelicans suddenly lose 2, maybe 3, and everybody else around you wins, well, suddenly you might be talking about that 9-10. So you're literally going game by game. And this was something I think everybody wanted to avoid, right, hoping that there would be some separation, maybe some teams not playing for something. And look, that still may happen, right? The second to last game of the year comes against Golden State. What if they lose these next couple of games and suddenly they're locked into 10? Do they even play Steph Curry against the Pelicans? And same thing with the Lakers. What if they're locked in the position? Do they play LeBron? I highly doubt it. So much can happen between now and then.
You know, another player that's really been surging of late and had a massive impact on last night's game is Jose Alvarado. And I think it kind of gets forgotten when it's not a guy who's in the starting lineup. When you're listing guys who are out, it's, obviously B.I. is the first one to get thought of. But it felt like, I don't know if they win last night's game without him either. So how big is his impact, and how much do you think that'll play into a potential playoff series or these last few games down the stretches? Is hopefully having him continue to stay healthy and giving you that spark, which he can do it in different ways. Last night the scoring was more than you usually get from him as well.
Yeah, I wish we could tell Jose that the remaining four games are against the Phoenix Suns. He seems to bring the biggest amount of energy and all that comes with in his little small package of, you know, being vocal, getting into the opponent's faces and such. But, no, generally when he's been out there, it's been a great thing for the Pelicans. And I was curious about this morning, actually, looking up his wins and losses. Did you know this, that with Jose playing, Pelicans are 35-17 this year. Without him, they're 11-15. So he makes a huge, huge impact. And we see it off the bench, right? As you mentioned, there was a scoring last night. And I think, without a doubt, they don't win that game if he doesn't come in and hit those two threes right from the start, right? He comes in the game. They're 10 minutes in. I think the Pelicans had like 11 or 12 points on the scoreboard. Couldn't make a shot. But he hits two threes, and suddenly CJ's going, and Jose finishes off the first half by hitting another two threes. And, of course, you know what he does defensively, right, and getting under the skin of opposing players. So that's always going to be there. But when he's making a shot, it adds another level. So without Jose, yeah, I don't think the Pelicans are even probably close to the team they are, because that's what this team is, right? It's built on a very good to great bench. You also, in addition to Jose, you got Larry, Trey Murphy, when the starting lineup's healthy, right, with B.I. in there. And Dyson, we've seen what Dyson's done last four games, and Najee, right? So this team relies on, I think, that momentum, right, that energy off the bench to where it creates an impact defensively, and that allows you to get out. It allows you to all of a sudden go on 10-0 runs and stuff, because you're starting from the defensive standpoint first, which is what Willie Green preaches. And that's the strength of this team, right? It's the fifth best defense across the league, and in big part because of that bench. And that helps the scoring, because they don't have the Devin Bookers, KDs, some of these other more stacked lineups of proven scorers like other teams in the league.
You know, Ollie, we've already had the conversation of why the Jonas Valanciunas minutes are what they are at times. So, you know, we don't have to get back into that, because whether I agree with it or not, it's how they've chosen to approach this. But in a game like last night, where he only plays a season-low 4 minutes, do you think Jonas is just, you know, mature enough and built enough to handle that type of situation? Because he plays 30 minutes on Friday, and he can just handle the ups and downs of getting a ton of minutes or not playing at all? Or do you think that really bothers him?
No, 100%. He's been a professional through and through. And whether you talk to other teammates in front of the camera, behind the camera, coaching staff, yeah, that's what they all say. And Jonas proves it. I noticed in the second half, he was being vocal and cheering on his team. In his mind, he probably knew he was going to see another minute in that game. But it was pretty obvious. He didn't play the rest of that first half out of your initial burst. And starting always second halves has been Larry Nash for the most part for the last couple of months. So he knew he was going to play. And that's been the direction, right, Willie's taken. Last month, he played under 20 minutes per game, and it's been trending downwards. They want to play small. And I thought last night, actually, going small helped. Right, Jonas had some shots early, missed a couple of threes. Team had four turnovers, just couldn't get anything going. By taking Jonas out, you're suddenly forcing Nurkic to be more of a defender, right, to get out of the lane. And I thought that's really why the Pelicans won, right? They kept Nurkic off the board. Thank goodness Dyson, Nance, they got really physical with him, didn't allow him to have that impact. But if you can do that, if you can hold your own when you're playing small, and specifically you got to look at the rebounding, I think that's the way to go with this team. Because unless you're playing a Jokic, a Gobert, unfortunately, Valanciunas' his impact, it just drops so much because just the style of the play of the league nowadays.
We're talking with Ollie Cassell. He covers the New Orleans Pelicans. Ollie, when can we expect Brandon Ingram to come back? Do you think it's going to be within the next couple of games, or do you think it would have to be once we get either into the play-in tournament or into the beginning of the playoffs?
Yeah, if I had to guess, earliest would be that Golden State Warriors game, right? He's obviously not going to play in a back-to-back, so it would be one of those two games. And more likely, I've got to think it would be for Golden State, because you've got to think you've got enough to beat Sacramento, and that also gives him another day of rest. And fortunately, he has been looking better, right? Over the last week now, he's doing some jogging. He's actually shooting jumpers, right? So he's adding impact to all his workouts. That's to where before he wasn't, right? Shooting standstill shots. Running on like zero gravity type of machines. But this is kind of a pretty quick ramp up. So everybody's hopeful that he has no setbacks. Maybe war his game, but I think he would make himself available for that Lakers game, especially if it means anything.
And you brought it up a little bit earlier, but do you think that for the Pelicans to avoid the play-in tournament, they have to go 3-1 in this last four games, or do you think they could get away with going 2-2 with how the Suns schedule plays out?
At a minimum, I think you've just got to go 3-1, right? 2-2 means what? Phoenix goes 1-3, and hey, they've got a tough schedule, right? Timberwolves are remaining on schedule, 2 against the Clippers, 1 against the Kings. Got to think they'll beat the Kings. They're just, you know, unfortunately for them, falling off a cliff, even though they've got Monk and Sabonis. Clippers, it's hard to see how you maybe lose twice to a team when you're kind of evenly matched. So I'm thinking Phoenix is going to go minimum 2-2. So like I said, 3-1, best case scenario, right? 4-0. Just hope for one Phoenix loss.
Yeah, we'll hope for that. Ollie, appreciate you coming on. Keep up the tremendous work you're doing, and we'll get you on soon.
All right, guys, absolutely. Let's have a strong finish, right?
Absolutely. Appreciate you.
All right, guys.
And that was Ollie Cassell covering the New Orleans Pelicans. We're going to go ahead and take a quick timeout, but when we come back, we'll have more RP3 D'Lo and Mesh after this.
The biggest headlines in the world of sports are discussed here. ESPN 1037 Lafayette and 1041 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana's sports station.
Welcome back to RP3 D'Lo and Mesh as you're listening to ESPN Southwest Louisiana Sports Station. Looking at the poll question of the day, we had asked you on Facebook and on X, who's going to win the national championship tonight between UConn and Purdue? 68% of you have gone with the Huskies, while the other 32% are saying the Boilermakers. Still waiting on a couple more comments. Don't forget, you can leave your thoughts on Facebook and on X.
Yeah, you know, another thing too, and I kind of mentioned this a little bit, but Stephon Castle was kind of the shining star there in the semifinal game. He's the freshman for UConn, and you know, I think some of that was a result of how they were being defended, and they chose to go to him. He had 2 points against Illinois in the Elite Eight, and yet he had 21 in the Final Four matchup. It's clearly been, that's what I think shows you how good Dan Hurley is as a coach. To take what the defense is doing, and that's why I loved that breakdown that Jay Wright did, where he showed you, you know, early on the recognition of the plan against them and then how Hurley exploited it. And then, of course, you got to have a player step up and make some big-time plays, and despite just being a freshman, Castle was ready for that, and he did so. So I wonder, too, if you're Purdue, there's so many different elements of this, but how do you try to contain what UConn can do offensively? Because, you know, look, that's another aspect of, and we talked to our guy Jack Cavett about it, who follows this team as close as anybody. The difference is they have more than one guy. There's not a single name. Now, Klingon's the name you're going to hear about the most going into tonight's game because he's the player that can maybe throw something physically at Edie that throws him off of his game. But UConn's got any number of players. And look, whether it's Cam Spencer, who's come up at different points this season, of course, Newton's their other guard, and Castle that I just talked about, they will go in a lot of different directions. The one thing that they didn't have a lot against Bama, and, you know, at different points in the season, they haven't necessarily had a lot of it, but that's mainly because they haven't needed it, is they won't have a ton of bench scoring, and they won't have a ton of different players impact this game in a large way off the bench. I will be interested to see if this game gets officiated a certain way, and you start to see foul trouble be a part of it. I hope it's not, and we've seen so far in this tournament, I think, an emphasis on letting guys be physical and not calling early ticky-tack fouls. But if UConn has to go to their bench, too, I think that could make that could change things. And it's not to say they can't do it, because again, every time they've needed someone to step up, they have, whether it's the eighth guy on the bench or the leading scorer of the team. So we'll see if that impacts this in any way. But the ability of Hurley early on to see what Purdue's going to throw at him and change his offensive plan, I think will be another early chess move that's pretty fascinating to watch.
And let's see if they're actually going to let them play, right? Like, we saw in the women's championship game that South Carolina was allowed to be physical with Iowa, in particular Caitlin Clark, and they let it go, right? They let them play. And the Gamecocks' height and wingspan frustrated Clark the rest of the way and the rest of that Iowa team. You would hope that that's how it goes, right? You hope that the game is not decided by officials. That's what I don't have a rooting interest here. I don't root for UConn or Purdue, I just want to see an entertaining game that isn't decided by the refs. That's all.
I agree. And, you know, usually I think we would get that. The other thing, too, I think they did a good job. The same thing could be said in some of the semifinals. I really did think they let him play in those games for the men. And, you know, at times it's always kind of a give and take. I think on the national spotlight, too, there's always sometimes officials worry about the physicality taking over and maybe somebody starts to get frustrated and you get some physicality, some shoving, maybe something extracurricular, which you don't want to see in a championship game. But I think these two teams, as well coached as they are, they know what the moment's about. And I made that same comment to my dad during the semifinal game because he was kind of saying, man, this is getting real chippy. I wonder. But the players on the floor understand the moment. And I think these two teams specifically, like UConn, as we've mentioned, has been all the way here. Purdue, of course, with their shortcomings and knowing how hard it was to get here, I think they'll understand the moment. And I don't think they'll allow that physicality to boil over into something extra. And if that's the case, then yeah, I think it's not only what you'd like to see. I think it's the duty of the officials to allow this game to be played on the floor by the teams and not make it about them. We've seen some ump shows in recent memory.
Well,
here
just the other day for the women, and whether you agree with it or not, that on the screen they called UConn
certainly
for the foul, and that became a hot button issue on Friday night because that essentially secured the win for Iowa. Now, do I think it was the right call? The view that you saw on TV is not the view that you ended up seeing later on, where you go, okay, it's obvious that that was a foul, but they decided to make that call with, you know, seconds remaining in a Final Four game.
Yeah, is it a moving screen? Yes. Do I wish they wouldn't have called it? Also, sure. I'd rather see if that shot goes down. I don't know if we have a big, but it is. Like, it's a moving screen. And that stuff gets called a lot more in the college game. I saw someone comparing it to some NBA calls. You can't compare it. The NBA allows way a completely different set of rules. A, the rules are different themselves, and B, the officiating of it is different as well. But, yeah, she definitely was moving. She definitely extended the elbow. I think it's a moving screen that gets called all the time. In that moment, I would rather them, because I don't think it's impacting the play that much. I'd like it to be let go, but I can't fully fault them. I don't think that was nearly as egregious as a lot of the... That's not even close for me, which I saw some people say they thought it was worse. It's not even close for me as the missed shot or the block shot that was allowed or not allowed. It was called a foul early in the tournament, if you'll remember, that everybody was losing their minds about. The block from behind. I don't think that's that at all. I think that was a correct call, whereas the block shot was incorrect. He blocked it clean, and they called a foul, and it changed the outcome of that game. I think this was a correct call in that situation. I'd prefer them not to, but I didn't get too upset either way on it because by the rules, the official had it right. And, you know, again, it's tough to make that judgment call in that spot.
Absolutely. And kind of getting back with the men, with how the refs are going to official make the calls in this game, if they're letting them play, I think you can really test how much can you get away with affecting Zach Edey. Because if you can try and throw him off his game, which is going to be tough, if you can throw him off his game in any way, I think that's in huge favor of UConn. Because I worry about the supporting cast for the Boilermakers compared to what the rest of the Huskies have in their supporting cast.
I agree with that to an extent. And, you know, I do also wonder, look, Purdue had a lot of open looks in the semifinal game that they missed from the outside, where you get Edey down low, back and down.
Mm-hmm. It was a lot
kicks
from the
out
wing
to the corner.
Top.
Yeah, and they missed a lot of open shots. I don't think they can miss nearly as many of those if they want to win this game. I think that's for sure, because UConn is going to take advantage. UConn's going to have some runs. The other thing you have to guard against if you're Purdue, and this is where I think coaching really comes into it, we hear a lot about timeouts and when to take them and all this stuff, and I think sometimes it gets a little overrated. This is a UConn team that put together a 30-0 run against one of the best teams in the country in Illinois a few weeks ago. Like, you have got to be able to limit the runs when UConn gets on them. And if you're Painter, the Purdue head coach here, I think you got to be really selective and you have to really pay attention to when you're using timeouts. Because if UConn's allowed to just keep rolling, and look, in that 30-0 run, obviously you had multiple stoppages in between there. It didn't slow them down. But can you avoid the massive, the 16-0 run, the 14-0 run? Can you keep UConn's runs to 6-8? I think then you stay in the game and you have a shot.
Are we going to make our picks on this game later on before we sign off today?
I think we could do that for our final segment.
Ooh, she put you on the spot, Dawson. You have 2 degrees. You should be able to adjust on the fly, though.
Yeah, I'll come up with something.
he seems so put upon. I'll come up with something. I'll figure it out somehow.
You just did deep
analysis on the national championship game tonight, and then we're like, "Hey, do you want to make a pick?" And you're like, "I don't know. I don't know if I'm equipped to do so."
No, I can do so. I just don't like making picks because then they're wrong, and then I get yelled at. So. Not really.
I think you. I was gonna say, I think you've done better than
I've
the
had
two
a pretty good
us.
Success rate, but
you've
you
had
know,
a good
still,
run. You've had still, a good
they,
run.
The haters come after you when you lose, no matter if you're 90% win percentage or 30%.
Bud, the haters are gonna hate. The ballers are gonna ball.
That's how it works. That's how that song goes. Something like that.
We got to take a timeout when we come back. We're going to talk the state of the Houston Astros. They actually won a game. One of them. Brian LaLima will join us, our buddy from Houston. That's next right here on ESPN Southwest Louisiana Sports Station.
Back to the sports talk you not only want, but need. This is ESPN, 1037 Lafayette and 1041 Lake Charles. Southwest Louisiana's sports station.
We welcome you back into RP3, D'Lo and Mesh, a Monday edition of the show. We have covered a lot of bases, and it's time to cover a few more bases, maybe some bases on the baseball diamond itself, with our guy Brian LaLima of Sports Talk 790 over in Houston. Brian, I know it's got to be a little bit better Monday morning based on the events that happened late on Sunday. How are you doing?
Hey, well, you know, guys, can we talk about the eclipse for a moment, or you just guys want to talk Astros?
No, let's go. What you got?
No, I have no clue with this eclipse. All I know is I got home to my house about 30 minutes ago, and it was raining here, so I don't know if we're going to be able to see it or not. But hopefully this eclipse, man, you know, brings some better baseball for the Astros. And to answer your question, yeah, it was a little bit better last night. Renell Blanco is filthy, man. I mean, he's, what, 14 and a third innings of no-hit baseball? 44 outs without a hit so far for Renell Blanco. I mean, he's just been unbelievable.
He has. And, you know, my first thought to it, I do. The only concern I have is that he's unveiling essentially a new pitch in his changeup. He's thrown it a little bit, but it's basically a new pitch for him. And, you know, I do imagine as hitters get some data on this and they can go into the lab, of course, they're going to figure out some plans against it. But it doesn't change the fact that he's locating it and he's spotting a fastball in the mid to, you know, low to mid 90s, and he's got a breaking ball when he needs it as well. I think there could be some sustainability here. Where are you on that?
Now, I'm in the same boat as you. The thing that I like the most about the changeup, you hit on it, and it was one of the things that I was going to prep and talk about with you guys today, is the fact that he can locate his changeup. And I'm going to use an Adolis Garcia at bat facing Renell Blanco last night. If I'm not mistaken, he painted a changeup away on Adolis Garcia, and then later on in the at-bat, he brought it back down and in, and Adolis Garcia swung right through it. And then later on in the game, there was one where he missed high, but he was still able to elevate it to the top part of the zone that the hitter could not get to it, and I believe he fouled it off. But even then, even when he was missing with locating that changeup, he's still changing eye level, and he's working different quadrants of the plate. And, you know, the horizontal movement on his changeup has been filthy in his first two starts. So with sustainability, I don't know what it is about this cat, man, but just so far early, I know it's a small sample size this season at least. He's only had 9 career starts in his major league career, but the small sample size shows that he's got the sustainability to be I mean, right now he's the best guy on the staff. There's no question about that either.
And the other great thing about it that I'll get into now is you're not even going to ask him to be the ace of the staff or anything like that, because not only do you have players in front of him right now, but Justin Verlander made a rehab start. Obviously, the line doesn't look great. I usually don't pay attention to that at all. I think guys are working on something specifically in those rehab starts. Did it give you any pause on JV, or are you excited to welcome him back as soon as he's ready?
No, man, I think for me, you know, watching, you know, some of the highlights from him pitching in Sugarland for the Space Cowboys last night, he threw a changeup. I can't remember if it was 8 times or 11 times. I'd have to go back and look at my notes, but that number's elevated. So it seems to me he was working on throwing his changeup and his off speed. His velocity sat anywhere between 93 to 95 miles an hour. That's obviously a good sign when the fastball velocity can get up to 95 still in a rehab start. At his age, I'm like you, man. I don't pay attention to stat lines when big leaguers go down to AAA or even AA. Like, sure, it's cool to see you know, if he would have gone out and threw three scoreless with, you know, five punchies and things like that. But I don't pay any attention to it. I believe he's going to get one more rehab start, and then he should be back with the big league squad. And honestly, I think when he gets back to this rotation, it should add to the confidence level for these guys. Even though coming into Friday and Saturday this past weekend, the rotation for the Astros ERA-wise was top in the league. So in the middle relief and back end was obviously where the issues were. But, yeah, when he gets back, it's going to be a welcome sight, that's for sure.
And the last thing on pitching before we switch over to some lineup stuff, you know, Josh Hader got the save last night, did give up a run, didn't look particularly sharp. That ninth inning was a little bit more eventful than maybe we would have liked it to have been from an Astros perspective. And, of course, Presley had the blow up early in the weekend and yesterday. Kind of funny to see him basically show the frustration after he gets a clean inning, acting like, where has this been? Do you have any concern with those two guys, specifically Hader, because that first outing was so electric against the Yankees, but it's been a little bit of a mixed bag since then?
I think my concern is just with and you can also throw Brian Abreu in this too, because him and Ryan Presley and Saturday, they both got lit up. And Brian Abreu at one point last year was one of the best arms in the bullpen throughout all of Major League Baseball. I mean, through everybody. There was like a 18, 19, 20 straight innings without giving up a run, a hit, something crazy like that. He got blown up Saturday as well. These arms between Brian Abreu, Ryan Presley, and Josh Hader are too good to struggle like we have seen early. I honestly think that it's a comfortability thing on where they are coming out for their appearances. Brian Abreu is not used to the seventh, whether it's the seventh, eighth, or ninth. These guys have had such good routines over the last couple of years, being the eighth inning guy and the ninth inning guy. Now you have a completely different realm for these guys. They're getting in games earlier. I think it's just going to take a little bit longer for them to get more comfortable. And when that happens, you'll start to see this stuff really electrify, because there's no question about those three arms are three of the best arms in the bullpen in all of Major League Baseball. I just think it's a comfortability thing as of right now.
We're talking with Brian LaLima of Sports Talk 790 in Houston. He joins us here on RP3 D'Lo Amesh. He is notoriously a slow starter, but we thought maybe this year, Brian, that Alex Bregman, because of what he showed in spring ball, would start off hotter. He started off 6-for-32 for the season. What are you seeing with Bregs at the plate?
I just see, you know, an extremely competent hitter that's just struggling right now. There's no question that he is a grinder. He will do anything and everything to try to get better. But as of right now, it's just things aren't working for him. And a concern for me, just knowing what Alex Bregman does in his at bats, even though he's a notorious slow starter, and even though the hits might not be there, the walks are usually at the top of the league, and we haven't really seen that so far this season. So, obviously, he's going to tweak with his mechanics. He's always looking to get better every single day with how he approaches it, looking at film and, you know, getting in the lab, so to speak, and things like that. But, man, it's been a struggle early. There's no doubt about it.
Sorry, I stand corrected. It was – started off 6-for-35, which is even worse.
Yeah.
An interesting stat – is when they score 8 or more runs, they win. When they score 4 runs or less, they've lost every game. With the starting pitching being as good as it is, but the bullpen has been a mess, does this lineup really need to score 5 runs a game, essentially, to ensure that they have a shot at winning a ball game?
It's a crazy stat, Mesh. I mean, it's I saw that this morning as well when I was prepping for our show. And real quick, one more thing on Alex Bregman, just to go back to your question, it just popped in my mind. He's hit a lot of balls hard, just right at guys early in the season. So keep that in mind as well. And you know, further down the road, that's going to finally, they'll find their holes. But,
well, I don't disagree with that, Brian, but like we've had this conversation about Bregs now for the last 3 to 4 years that he hits the ball really hard. It just doesn't get into play. So
yeah, that's fair. That's fair. I'm with you. It's frustrating,
but go ahead to your point. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm just like, and again on that, it's like we say, you know, here in Houston, like there are two positions right now in the lineup, first and third base offensively. First base is an absolute disaster for the Astros right now. It is a hole, and there's no question about it. And people can say the same thing about Jose Abreu. Oh, he's a slow starter. Alex Bregman's a slow starter. Well, for me, I'm greedy. We can't have slow starters. Like, you need to perform. Give me production over, you know, production down in September, because right now they're 3-7. I'm not panicking, but it's a concern. So these guys need to they need to, at first base specifically, they need to figure it out. Whatever they're going to do with Jose Abreu, sit him down for a couple of days, let him rest, maybe throw Victor Caratini over there to play first base and have Yonier behind the plate, or put Victor Caratini behind the home plate and have Yonier Diaz play first to rest his legs, whatever it is, that's a hole at first base. And as far as the runs are concerned, yeah, no, you shouldn't have to score four or more runs, five or more runs to win ball games with, you know, a pitching staff that, for the most part so far, outside of Hunter Brown, you had one good start for Framber Valdez. Christian Javier's looked pretty good. Ronel Blanco's had two good outings. So has J.P. France. Verlander's on the verge of coming back. I just think, man, should you have to score five more runs to win? No, but that's, I mean, eight or more runs you win, and less than four runs you don't. It's crazy. With the bullpen they have, the back end, a three-run lead should be secure, but what we've seen early, it's not.
I feel like Diaz is really kind of rose to the occasion with the work that he's doing behind the plate and with his bat. I know it's early. We're only, what, 10 games in, but what do you make of the new everyday catcher for the Astros?
I mean, he's as good as advertised, that's for sure. You know, last year we clamored for more at-bats for Yonier Diaz, and unfortunately we didn't get it. You know, Dusty Baker wanted to go with Martin Maldonado. The lineup last year was inconsistent as it was, and that's one knock against Dusty and what he was doing as the manager of the Astros. And then, you know, we spoke with Dana Brown every single Wednesday last year on our show, on the Sean Salisbury Show on Sports Talk 790, and he said time after time, Yonier Diaz is the catcher of the future. And in the small sample size we've seen, he's caught a no-hitter. He's hitting, what, over 340 or whatever it is? I mean, it might have tipped down a little bit. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but he's as good as advertised. Now, over the weekend, a little bit of a negative, if you will, there were some pass balls because instead of trying to drop and block, he tried to scoop them backhand, and balls kicked away. And that could be maybe a sign of maybe the legs are a little bit tired because he's never caught this many innings before in his career. So that's kind of why I said, hey, maybe throw him at first base to give his legs a rest from behind the plate. But so good, you know. And another thing is, one of the things that we heard last year was, oh, well, he's not ready to call his own games. He's got to learn that aspect. I think he's done pretty well so far this year on calling games behind the plate.
We're talking to Brian Lima of Sports Talk 790. Brian, I checked with you. Yonier is .316 for his batting average, and he's got a slugging percentage of .500.
Okay.
I did want to ask you about this matchup tonight. How do you feel about the lineup against Andrew Heaney?
Well, so obviously Altuve is going to hit leadoff. The 2, 3, 4, 5, I think, can be tweaked a little bit. And it's not just against Andrew Heaney. It's against anybody. Heaney's pretty good. Don't get me wrong. But just talking Astros lineup just in general, I understand the theory behind Yordan in the two hole. You want to get him more at-bats. He's your best hitter. But the way that, you know, Bregman is struggling, the way that Yonier is excelling, and Kyle Tucker's obviously right there hitting pretty well so far this season, I would make some tweaks. I would maybe put Kyle Tucker at the two hole, or even Bregman at the two hole. Maybe Bregman can work more counts and get more walks. If there are tweaks, it's got to be the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 or 2, 3, 4, 5, excuse me, from Joe Espada. But I think he's going to continue to roll out that same lineup. I would assume that we'll see Chaz McCormick back in left and Jake Meyers in center field because of the bigger outfield. So you're not going to have Yordan out there. I really don't know who's going to play first base tonight. Is it going to be Jose Abreu? Do we see Caratini behind the plate or at first base? That's yet to be determined, and the lineup won't be released until about 3 o'clock or so. But something's got to be fixed at first. I know that.
And here's a quick one. Do the Astros split with the Rangers?
Yeah, of course, man. Eclipse 2024, yes. Come on.
There it is.
Come on. Yeah, we're going to – hey, look, this is what's going to happen.
Okay.
Frommer's going to throw another gem. They're going to win 5-2.
Oh, okay. There we go. Little too much for Kevin Foote's sanity, but we'll take
it. Heard it here first. No, he loves those types of games. He wants baseball. 5-2s is his one, almost his ideal.
He usually likes 5-3s.
He's insane. Anyway, that's neither here nor there.
I don't know, man. I'm just trying to be as optimistic as possible. Like I said earlier, I'm not panicking, but it's a small sample size, 10 games in. So let's just be positive. Positive vibes only. Look, I know you guys are in Louisiana, okay, and you might not see the eclipse. But look, we'll see it over here, and I'll let you know how it goes.
There you go, Brian.
Take a picture for us.
Appreciate the time, Brian. Yeah. We'll catch up with you again next week.
I'm going to look directly into the eclipse for you guys. No glasses.
We don't recommend that, for the record. Appreciate the time, Brian.
Appreciate it, guys. Talk to y'all next week.
That's Brian Lelimo, Sports Talk 790. We'll take our final timeout. We'll wrap up today's show on the other side.
You're listening to ESPN 103.7 Lafayette and 104.1 Lake Charles. Your home for the best local sports talk in Southwest Louisiana.
Wrapping up this Monday edition of RP3 D'Lo and Mesh as you're listening to ESPN Southwest Louisiana Sports Station. Looking at our poll question of the day really quickly before we turn it over to our picks for this game. Who do you think is going to win tonight in the national championship between the Purdue Boilermakers and the UConn Huskies? 69% of you have gone with UConn. 31% have said Purdue.
Yeah, for me, I'll start it off. I'm going to go, why not? Let's pick against the favorite. Let's go Purdue. I think Zach Edey has been on a mission here. Both of these teams have kind of convinced themselves that it's them against the world, even though they're the two favorites of the whole tournament, which I like, because again, you got to do that. It's that rat poison, right? Kirby Smart, Nick Saban, they'll tell you all about it. But I like Klingon's ability to neutralize Edey, but I think in the end, Edie's still going to get his. And more importantly, I think Purdue knocks down more shots than they did in the last couple games. And I think they'll have to, because Edey will get the attention. He'll get those kickouts. I think their shooters on the outside hit a few more. And I think in the end, it's enough to pull away with a very narrow victory. Give me Purdue in an upset. Somewhat of an upset.
What's the score?
We'll go 75-72.
Oh, we're taking scores on this, too? It's so tough with college
basketball. I wasn't prepared,
but
I'll just come up with it.
Man, just threw out a number. We don't need numbers. We don't need numbers. No, just
pick a number. I threw a number too.
No, we'll just throw. No, we don't need numbers. We don't need numbers. That wasn't part of the assignment.
Throwing off the whole mojo.
I know.
It's like when the teacher doesn't say to show your work, and then you turn in your math problems, everything's right, because you didn't show your work. Well, you didn't ask. So
we've done it every other time.
You didn't ask for a score, and then you're just.
We've done it every other time.
That's exactly what the teacher would say. You may have missed your calling, James.
No, education.
We'll get
still
you
time.
With Brett Chansey. We'll get you with him. He'll get you a job.
Oh, well, we'll have Brett Chansey mentor you in all things.
All
being
things
a teacher.
Teaching.
Huh? How to run a podcast successfully. Wildly successful. I locked on Ashton.
I need to ask him on that.
There we go.
There it is.
We found it.
It's UConn. Alabama maybe played their best game of the season and still lost by, double digits. So, I know Zach is the man, and he's on a mission, and that's great. And Pels fans are imagining what he looks like in a Pels uniform. UConn's the defending champs. They know what it takes. I like them tonight to win a hard-fought game. That's going to do it for us. I want to thank our
guests.
I'll
take UConn, by the way.
Yeah.
I thought you already you sat there and you rambled. I already gave. Blah, blah, blah.
I was saying I had a score ready.
2 UConn, 1 Purdue. We'll be back. Loaded lineup of guests tomorrow, and we'll tell you about them tomorrow because we ran out of time today. Enjoy the eclipse.